them commenting, why do you guys still living there?
I don't live there. Yes. Well, I live in Belize now, but I am still a U.S. citizen, and I still see that the work in the United States and in industrialized countries is some of the most important work, because in the U.S. we have some of the least amount of people, and we have one of the largest negative impacts on the planet. We consume more water, more energy, more resources, more of the wealth of this world than any other country with one of the smallest populations. And so although I don't like the United States and I don't like the U.S. government, I don't let that obstacle stop me from getting going there and doing the work that needs to be done. I did choose, through my being, to choose another place to live because I got mostly because of my health. I have very serious health challenges, and it is a very real obstacle. And after years of struggling to breathe, after years of being in chronic pain, it hurts to walk for me. Like, walking hurts. And therefore, anything more than that hurts even more. And not being able to get a full breath and struggling to breathe all the time, I realized I wanted to prioritize my own well-being because I have this tendency to always take care of everything and everyone else first. And part of the reason I did that is because growing up as a child, my childhood was very unsafe and very violent. And no one was there to take care of me when I needed it. So I became this superhero to take care of all the versions of me in the world. You know, it's like I took my past, which we all usually do at some point. I took my past of a troubled, brutal childhood. And whenever I see something suffering, if I can help it, I swoop in and I try and help because I'm reliving that for the little girl that I was that didn't get to have that growing up. And when I had that aha for myself, that realization, I realized I wanted to move somewhere where I could be healthy so that when I do the work, I come from a more healthy place instead of being sick and struggling all the time. But when it comes to the obstacles of the U.S. and the government and the corporations, in some ways, I feel that it's some of my most important work is there. Because if I can shift the minds of people in the United States, the impact around the world is huge because of how powerful the choices are in that country. We are so destructive as a country. And I feel that because I had the awakening I've had as a U.S. citizen, it's part of my joyful responsibility to do work there. But part of what I had to do was look at in my being, I wasn't going to keep working there because I felt I should, right? I would only work in the U.S. when I feel really inspired and moved so that when I come up against the big obstacles that are in the U.S., I have a passion and a fire to overcome that obstacle versus just being depleted and frustrated. Yeah? Thanks. Anybody else? Yes.
I find your approach of first the being and then the doing very, very good. But my question is, how do you get to know your being? You said something about it, but perhaps you can say a bit more, because I think that's a very, for me, actually, it's the most difficult question.
Great. Thanks. I'll touch on it a little bit. For those who were in the seminar together later this afternoon, we're going to begin the process that actually helps you get to your core purpose. And it takes longer than a day, but we're going to begin the process together as a group today so that you can see how it actually works and you can start to do it in your life if you feel moved to do it. Very quickly, part of how you get to your core being is you actually make a list. But it's not a list you think very hard about. You literally think about what are the qualities, the characteristics that you really like and appreciate in yourself and in others. So it might be generosity. It might be humor. It might be someone who's really committed. Anything that without thinking too hard about it, you just start writing as it comes to your mind. What are the qualities, the characteristics, the personalities in yourself and in others that you really like? Not just the things you kind of like, but the stuff that you're like, yeah, that's important to me. Write it all down. And then once you got it all written out, sometimes people have to take a break and sit for a little bit. When you find yourself thinking too hard about it, put the paper and the pen down and go do something else for a while, and you can come back to it. But I tell people, don't come back to it more than one more time. After that second time, it's there. What you need is already there. Some of us who think too hard, we have to take a break because our brain gets in the way. It can be a tool, but it can also be a tool that holds us back and breaks the machine because it gets in the way. So once you get all the words written down, then you look for themes that the words connect under. So an example being that part of my purpose is joy, integrity, and loving joyous service. When I did the list for myself, there was inspiration as one of the things I like, humor, happiness, playfulness. They were all on the list. And I looked for a word that I felt most held all of those, and for me it was joy. That when I'm inspired, joy is present. When I'm laughing, joy is present. When I'm being playful, joy is present. So I've grouped all of those words under joy. For the word integrity, I'm very passionate, very fierce, actually, a little bit obnoxious sometimes, about making sure that what we say and what we do match. And when it doesn't, I become fierce. And sometimes I'm a little bit like a bulldozer. It can be a bit too much. But I'm very, very fierce about, we can't say that forests should be protected and then get coffee or tea in a paper cup and then throw it away. Like, there's an integrity out there for me. You can't say, protect those forests over there, but I'm going to destroy forest over here for something I don't even need to destroy it for. Like, there are things we need our forest for. We don't need it for paper cups, paper napkins, paper towels, paper bags, you know, plastic, the same thing. So I'm so fierce about integrity because I'm like, if we want a certain view of the world, we have to be living it. But when I was getting to the word integrity, I had all kinds of things like keeping your word, caring for others, and that one I ended up feeling like integrity and service went with that one. But I had a few different words, and then I felt that all of them were held under integrity. So you make the list, and you look for the themes, and then you distill it down. You want no more than 3 or 4 words. We like to have, sometimes we like to have really big mission statements. Some of us are like, and I am this, and I am that, and I am the entire world just waiting to come forth. And that's great, but it's not very potent. Right? So kind of like when you distill alcohol, it becomes stronger. If you distill herbs in a tincture, they become stronger. This process is a distillation process to help you become your most potent self. And those other things will fall underneath it, but you will know it when you get there, because when you say those words to yourself and you think, this is who I am called to be, you will feel yourself do this. Your body will literally start getting excited at the words. And the other words that aren't as meaningful or as important, you will find just does nothing to you. And that's actually part of how you get to your core purpose of being. It's that simple. And then another great part of the process, which we'll also start today, is you do the same thing with a list of the negative qualities and characteristics, the things you don't like about yourself and others. And the reason, and then you distill it down as well. And the reason you do that is because those words help you realize when you're out of purpose. Because when we experience, oh, that person's nagging, that person's lying, that person's this, that person's that, we like to make it be about them, right? Like, it's their problem. It has nothing to do with me. When we're living lives of purpose, it's a practice that says, I am 100% of the time co-creating my world. 100% of the time. I am not passively sitting here watching it being created around me. 100% of the time, I'm co-creating my world. Even if I'm doing nothing, that doing nothing has an impact, so it's co-creating my world. So when we do the negative words list, what it helps us realize is if when we start finding that people around us are behaving in that way, or we even start hearing people using those words, it's usually a good indicator that we're out of purpose. It actually helps us like get back on purpose, because those negative qualities, when they're showing up a lot, it usually means we are out of purpose, and so it's allowed for that energy to begin showing up in our life. So you can give it a whirl if you want and see what it brings forth for you. It's a great practice. I've actually even helped organizations do that process, and entire organizations have gotten on purpose, and their success as an organization has just leaped up because everybody got clear on not just the mission of the organization, but the purpose of the organization. And it's been kind of amazing, the results. So that's how you do it. Yes. How do I know what to put my energy into? Because I line it up with my purpose. My purpose, joy has to be present. Integrity has to be present. Love has to be present. And service has to be present. I could work all day, every day on every issue that I care about and still not do all the things that I could do, right? So what I'm looking at in my life, it's a little bit like putting a puzzle together. And if I already have a pretty full calendar, I might have a window here and a window there that's open where I could technically put something else in, but I know that if I did, my joy would disappear. Because my joy needs to make jewelry. My joy needs to make food. My joy needs to swim in the sea. My joy needs to ride a bike. My joy needs to do yoga. And all of that needs to fit in the calendar somewhere. And so if I'm just filling up the calendar with all everybody else's needs, I will see that my joy is beginning to disappear, and that means I'm out of purpose. So actually, my purpose very much helps me choose. But other things that help me choose is, I don't go to any region for one event. So when I was asked to come do this event, I have a lot of other allies in Europe, and I said, I told the organizer, before I can say yes, I have to double check and make sure that I can build up the other work that I need to do with my allies in the area, because I'm not going to take the Earth's resources and my resources to come all the way here for just this event. As awesome as you guys are, as fabulous as you are, as much as I know you're going to go out and make a huge difference in the world, that was important to me as well. But also was, okay, can I do the other things in the region that I know people are wanting me to do? So it's a little bit of the being piece, but it's also, there's a strategy on how I choose that's also based on time resources and Earth resources and all of that. Yes?
I'm Mira from Marburg, and my question is how it was for you to come back in the normal society after you were
How was it to come back in a normal society after the treason? Some of you know the answer to this because I was talking about it yesterday. I didn't really get a chance to come back to normal society. 36 hours after I touched the ground, I was in New York City. Yes. Every time I tell people that, people are like, and that's how I looked. Have you seen the pictures of me after I came down like this? You know, like my eyes are like this big, my mouth is open, like, ah! The reason I did that was because the media all over the world was paying attention to this story, and the media was going to tell the end of the story whether I was there or not. And New York is the hub for international news in the United States. And so I knew that if I didn't go to New York wasn't going to, like, the media would not push pause until I had enough time to deal with going to New York. They were going to tell the story when they were going to tell it. And I either had to be there or they were going to tell their version of it. And so I decided in my mind that the treason wasn't done until the media piece was done. That was the only way I could get myself to talk about another obstacle. Holy cow. I hadn't walked on the ground for 2 years and 8 days. I hadn't been around more than 3 people at a time for 2 years and 8 days. And all of a sudden I have to get in a car, get on a plane, freaked me smooth out, and land in New York City. And so, again, it's a perfect question, because when it comes to overcoming obstacles, I knew that my core being was committed to having what I wanted told about the issue. Because the media, basically, the way the media works, they pretty much would have said, Julia Butterfly came down, all the forests are saved, click to a commercial, go back to shopping. That would have been the final chapter of the treason in the media. And I just was like, that can't be the last message. I want people to know that, yes, we had a victory here, but forests all over the world need our help. And that's the message I want to get out. And so I got clear that my being was my commitment to that message, and I did what I needed to do, and I hyperventilated on the plane and had a crying attack. I freaked out and just went and did the work. And I actually didn't slow down for 6 months. I just kept going. And then 6 months later, I had a little bit of a meltdown and a breakdown, and I realized that I hadn't given myself a graceful transition. Everybody's like, oh my goodness, it's getting dark in here. Oh no, another obstacle! So yeah, that was my experience. Ta-da! And then there was light. Yes.
My question is, how do you get your energy? All these things, do it with very much energy.
How do I get the energy to do what I do and do it with so much energy? Well, first of all, it's kind of in my nature, right? Having this much energy got me in trouble growing up. And now I've just learned how to direct it into good things, right? So part of the gift of that is that really honestly, I mentioned this the first night, like really honestly, who we are is exactly who we're meant to be. Not everybody is meant to have this much energy. The world would be more chaotic than it already is if we all had this much energy, right? People would be like, "Wah!" It would be too much. It'd be like, somebody's got to chill out. So thank goodness there's some who are the Zen chill people. They hold the Zen chill part of life, and I'm like, the whoa, let's go part of life. And the world needs all of us, right? So part of where I get my energy is it's in my nature. And then I figured out how to use that for the things I care about. And also being clear about how it sometimes can be destructive for the things I care about. Because sometimes the moment is not calling for energy. It's calling for peacefulness. It's calling for mindfulness. It's calling for a calm conversation. But I've had to learn in my life how to be aware of that so that I can use my energy in appropriate ways and turn my energy down a little bit when it's not appropriate to have this much energy. But I also get my, I do get depleted. I do get burnt out and run down. And when I do, I know it's because I'm out of purpose somewhere and because I'm not doing the things that keep me healthy. And when I notice that, I prioritize doing what I need to do to get back on purpose and to be healthy. So that means I go do my yoga. I go swimming in the sea. I go ride my bike. I go sit with a tree and chill for a couple hours and let nature teach me. I do those things that help fuel my energy back up. Because I was definitely operating on fumes for a while. After I came down from the tree, I averaged 250 events a year. For 7 years, I was doing 250 events a year. And I had an organization that I was responsible for, so I also, when I got back off the road, I was still working. Because I had to meet with my team, we had to prioritize what the needs of the organization were, I had to help do the fundraising so everybody would get their paychecks paid. So I was usually working 3 months at a time without one day off. That was like average for me, and that was depleting. So part of how I keep my energy is by finding what balance for me means, and that's different for all of us. I happen to have more energy, so I can do a little bit more than some people, but there's a balance space for all of us. Thanks. There's a hand back there in the corner, I think. Did I see somebody back there somewhere? No? Okay. I thought I saw a hand. Back here, then. I'm sorry, what? Yes, do I sometimes visit the tree and still feel connected? I feel connected just about every day, you know, whether I'm there or not. That experience was so profound in my life that it's hard not to feel connected to it. You know, like it was so pivotal. It's so much a part of who I've become that it would almost be like forgetting myself to forget the tree. I usually go and visit the tree about once a year, but mostly I go to tell the area thank you. My experience in that tree really proved to me that nature is constantly communicating. Everything in life is constantly communicating, and it receives our communication too. And so I go back to tell the area thank you, because I don't want it to feel like it's been forgotten just because the famous Julia Butterfly went away. And I've since, being in that tree, I've had very real experiences of how nature communicates. There's a community in Italy called Dumnor, and they spent many years researching how plants communicate, and there was a big study done. There's a book called The Secret Life of Plants, if you're interested in it. And it's science that shows how nature communicates. And then this community in Dumnor built upon that science and did experiments with plants. And they now have a way for plants to communicate through music. And I've actually done performances with plants performing music in Italy, where I do poetry and the plants play the music. And as crazy as it sounds, the first time I had the experience with them, I walked into the area, the atrium, botanical garden area where the plants that perform the music are worked with. And I heard this beautiful symphony music coming out of the atrium. And I walked in, and a whole group of us walked in. And as we walked in, the music began to change. And the Dominorian said, "The music is changing because you all have entered the room. Walk back outside again and listen." We walked back outside, the music began to shift. Then he said, the plants were in a semicircle, and he said, "Julie, I want you to go sit in the semicircle of these plants." I went and I sat, and slowly the music started to change. Then he took, the way the plants perform music is they have these little wires that connect them to a synthesizer that has drums and guitars and all those kind of, you know, trumpets, horns, all of that. And so he took the little electric wires. They have these little teeny tiny clamps that they connect to the plant. They took it off, and one by one as he took it off, the music began to fade until it stopped. Then he reconnected the plants, and it was quiet for a minute. He said, the plants are taking a minute to read the energy of the room, and then they'll begin to perform. And then sure enough, slowly but surely, the music started to come. And it's not that they're performing, but they're communicating with the energy in the room. And when that happened, I started laughing. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing! And as I got excited, the music started getting really upbeat. And then I started to cry because I thought, you know, this experience I had in the tree proved to me that nature communicates, but very few people believe me. But these plants are showing people that, no, it really happens. And so I started to cry. And so, like, what would be possible for our world if we valued the communication of the natural world? And I started crying, and the music began to slow down and become melodic with my tears. And as I've now done performances with them, I allow the plants first to gauge the energy of the group, and they start playing the music, and then I start speaking the poetry into that, and as I begin to read the poetry and I begin to feel the poetry, the music changes every time and begins to match where my energy is with the poetry. So I just shared that long answer to your question only because that's part of why I go up to that area to say thank you, because I know that it knows when I do it. Thanks for your question. Yes.
So you talked about the way of being and the way of doing. Why do you think so many people choose the way of doing first? Is it because of the system, or there must be something in ourselves that's easier? Or what is it?
Great question. What is it that has us choose doing first instead of being first? It is a phenomenon that is very much a part of the industrialized world. When you go, the time I've spent with communities that are still living in an indigenous way, what they do is based on who they are. They have rites of passage that allows them to uncover their authentic being. And it's rites of passage that, like what I went through in the tree, parts of the rites of passage push them to their very edge, because it's only when our edges begin to crumble that we can really know who we are. Because before that, we have this very limited view of who we are and what the world is. But when we go to our edge and we melt that edge, our view of ourselves and our world expands. And so in communities that live in a more tribal way, they have rites of passage that cause people's view of themselves and their community to completely dissolve. In one tribal community, they have these gloves that are woven from reeds, and they fill them with fire ants, and they put their hands into the gloves with the fire ants. And the ants sting them and sting them and sting them and sting them and sting them. And that sounds like crazy. Why would they do that? But life sends you difficulties. And how you respond to that is who you, what makes you who you are. So this rites of passage that they go through doesn't kill them. It's just very, very painful and very intense. But it allows them to realize that they are bigger than what their mind thinks. And then they come out of that process, they get in, they have a ceremony that honors them for that transition, and they are given a new name that marks this new transition in their life. So in more tribal communities that are connected with the land, there's these whole processes that helps you know who you're called to be. You're not just automatically a hunter. You're not just automatically a medicine person. There's this process that helps you uncover who you're called to be in the community, and then you do whatever that job is from that place. But we live in industrialized societies that are all about production. It's all about units of production. I don't know what it's like here, but in the United States, in the news, you never see, almost never do you see the word citizen anymore. You see the word consumer, and you see the word taxpayer. You never, ever, ever see the word citizen in the media anywhere, anymore. That's an interesting thing to notice. How do we allow ourselves, and I don't know what it's like here, but in the United States, we allowed ourselves to go from being citizens of a democracy to being units of production, where we're either consuming that production or we're paying back to that production. So in production-driven societies and industrialized societies, we are no longer given the tools or supported in the process of uncovering our being. As a matter of fact, they try and stop it. Because the more we get clear on our being, the less we do things like consume, right? Because if I'm a woman in an industrialized society, I am taught that in order to be happy, I need to be wanted. In order to be wanted, I need to look a certain way. And therefore, I'm going to go buy this stupid outfit that costs way too much money, even though the people who made it weren't paid hardly anything. I'm going to go spend a lot of money I don't have for this outfit that was made by someone who was not honored for their time. And the minute I start feeling good in that outfit, guess what? The season changes, and now it's a whole new look. And now I gotta go buy something else. So when we're not clear on our being, we actually make better consumers. We make better production units because we're striving for something. When we're clear on our being, we don't have to strive anymore. And we don't make the system run so well when we're clear on our being. Thanks for the question. How are we on time?
15 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Yes?
I'm living on Hamburg, and I was wondering, after your experience as an entity with the plants and in the tree, how do you reconcile that with actually eating, like, plants and, I don't know, are you vegetarian or...
Yes. Yeah, that's a great question. Absolutely. With my experience in the tree and with plants, how do I reconcile that with eating plants? And I'm vegan, so all I eat is plants and fruits and grains. I'm one of the very few vegans in the vegan world who tells vegans that you're still taking a life. Like, get off your high horse. A lot of vegans who are in the vegan movement don't like me because I have a whole other view around veganism than what most people hold. And I recognize that even when I'm taking a plant, when I'm eating a plant, I'm taking a life. And before I eat, I actually have a prayer that I say to myself. And the prayer is, may my life live in honor of this life that has been given. And I say that to myself every time before I eat because I am clear that I'm taking a life. I don't have a way to exist as a human species in this world without causing some suffering, without taking some life. But I want to be mindful that I've taken that life. And my prayer is an offering that may that life that's been given to sustain me, may I honor it through the way that I speak, the way that I act, the way that I live my life. I choose to eat vegan because it's the way that I know that causes the least amount of suffering in the world. But I'm also a vegan who says you need to focus on local and biological, because a lot of vegans eat a lot of processed food that comes in a lot of packaging. And I'm like, well, that's not healthy for the earth either. That packaging was habitat at some point. And that habitat had some animals in it at some point. So I'm the one who's always looking at the whole systems going, how can I cause the least amount of suffering and the most amount of health and joy and prosperity, not in a money level, but prosperity meaning the wealth and abundance of all beings. And that's just why I choose to be vegan, because it's really about recognizing that I cause suffering just to exist and looking at how can I reduce the suffering that I cause and the suffering that I do cause, how can I be mindful of it and acknowledge it and ask that my life live in a way that honors the life that I've taken. Thanks for your question. Anybody else? Yes.
From your perspective, that the globalization is a chance for everyone to become his own idol and not just believe in the American dream or something.
And say the first part again, I didn't get it.
The globalization is a chance for everyone or possibility to become their own idol and not believe just in the American dream or nationalist dream.
To create a new story for themselves.
Yeah, being myself.
That's great. Thank you.
And what you're thinking about globalization is a bad way to give a new direction for the people in ourselves.
Well, globalization is happening. Globalization has been happening since before corporate globalization. Like, you know, little iguanas floated on pieces of bamboo and ended up on another island. You know, like, globalization's been happening for a while. But the thing that's caused an out of balance is the globalization of corporations and corporate power, because that's disconnected us from ourselves, it's disconnected us from our communities, it's disconnected us from the impact and the consequences of our choices. And that's the biggest challenge with the corporate globalization, because we do things and we are not connected to the impact. We buy a piece of clothing and we have no clue what the situation was for the person who made that piece of clothing. And once we get rid of it, we have no clue where it goes. So we are so disconnected from the impact of our choices that that's the biggest problem. And so I'm like, if globalization is happening, then how do we direct it in a good way, which is what you said? Have it be about reinventing a story for ourselves, a new story for what globalization can mean. I did a design for a T-shirt, and it is like street art, like tag art with a spray paint design, and it's got a big heart, and it says, globalize this. And like that, if globalization is happening, we can't say it shouldn't happen. It's happening. But what can we do with it that globalizes what we care about instead of what we are against, right? So how do we globalize love and compassion? How do we globalize awareness of the impact of our choices? How do we globalize a respect and an appreciation for diversity? If globalization is happening, let's make sure we globalize what we actually care about. Then, yeah.
I want to ask now, because in our world, in Europe and North America, we are thinking about if we have to go to school, university, earn money, and stuff like this. And other parts of the world, they are like more focused on other things. Like, I don't know, but I'm very underwhelming, and my parents are doctors, and in my life it's like, it's every time very, very fast, and I have to learn. I think nearly everybody is moved around like this. And do you think when you're a child, you become a kind of person, and when you grow up in a world like this, do you think really change yourself to become able to live in the very opposite kind of world? Do you think when you're a child, you learn so much, and then you're like nearly an adult, and you're a person. I don't know. It's like your arms like this, and you can change yourself. I feel like this. But do you think it's possible to really change yourself in this way?
It's a great question. Like, in the busy countries that we live in, and the busy families, and the busy societies, and by the time we're grown up, we have a kind of a very clear sense of ourself and what we're supposed to do, and all of that, it can feel really confining, right? It all of a sudden feels like my box of choices is this small. There are very real limitations and obstacles. If you live in this world and you want to have a roof over your head and food in your belly, you have to have money in this world. This particular part of the world, you have to have. So there are very real obstacles. But there are also very real possibilities for completely changing our life and changing the world around us. I've had that experience over and over again in my life. Part of it is always about questioning our belief systems. Like I was saying about the rites of passage that some communities have that allow people to completely reinvent themselves. Because when you're broken, like what happened to me in the tree, there's nothing like being completely broken to have an opportunity to reinvent yourself. It's like, I tell you, that's what happens. Like, we all love butterflies. We don't like to think about the liquefaction process, right? A caterpillar has to liquefy in order to become a butterfly. I'm pretty sure that's not a super comfortable experience. Right? Like, you're this caterpillar, munching on a leaf, life is good. All of a sudden, you feel this calling, you're not even sure why. You don't know you're going to become a butterfly. You just know you're supposed to do this thing. All of a sudden, you start winding yourself in a cocoon, and it gets really cramped in there, but then it gets a little comfy because it feels safe. And then all of a sudden, liquefaction! Oh my God! Like, a structure becomes liquid. So we all want the butterfly, but we don't want to have to go through the liquefaction process to get the butterfly. People come up to me and say they are jealous of me. And I tell them, no, you're not. You're jealous of the results. You want to be able to have muscles without working out. You know? You want to have a perfect body without eating healthy and getting exercise. That's what you want. You're not jealous of me. You're jealous of the results. You don't want to do the work. You don't want to liquefy. I had to liquefy. There were moments in that tree where I was literally curled up in the fetal position, rocking back and forth, sobbing my eyes out. I was in so much pain, emotionally, spiritually, physically. I was like, I cannot take another moment of this. But it was my mind that had very real limitations on myself that said, I can't take this. Somehow I took it. And every time I went through another hurdle, every time I went through another obstacle and transformed it, who I was transformed. I became a butterfly. But it's not like I'm now a butterfly. It's an every moment opportunity. I'm constantly looking for how to evolve myself as a being. I'm constantly looking for where are the limitations that I have allowed society to put on me or that I have put on me. There are real obstacles, but the biggest obstacles are made up. They're the thoughts we tell ourselves and the thoughts we allow others to tell us. And we begin to live as if that is fact, and it's not. There are people living in these busy, hectic, industrialized countries that are finding new ways of creating community. They're taking over abandoned lots and creating community gardens. They're taking over falling apart buildings, and instead of just redoing them in the toxic way, they're doing them in a permaculture way where they think in a permaculture design in the Rudolf Steiner methodology, and they rebuild entire neighborhoods with the kind of methodology that you learn in Rudolf Steiner where it's about whole systems and healthy. I mean, there's amazing things. I'll give you an example. In Oakland, where I used to live, in California, in West Oakland, there was 131 liquor stores and one grocery store in this community. 131 stores that sell alcohol, one grocery store. Why? Because the people who live in this community are extremely poor, and even though you can get a job where you're supposedly earning, it's called cost of living, you can get paid a cost of living job in California and not actually make enough to live. You actually can't pay the rent and the groceries and the utilities and everything. So when you are a person who wants to have something in your life and you don't have access to it, it's very easy to become an addict. And it's very easy to then turn to things like alcohol because then you can numb yourself to the fact that you're living in a frustrating world. And then you don't have money, so grocery stores don't want to come in because you don't have money to spend. 131 liquor stores, one grocery store. And this is going to be the final story, but it's about the power of what we choose to think and view in the world. Young people, youth in West Oakland said, we've had enough of this. We deserve healthy food. We deserve a healthy community. And if the government's not going to help us and the businesses aren't going to help us, we're going to do it ourselves. And young people went and found neighbors who had even little plots of land in their yards, even tiny ones in the city, like little tiny plots. And they said, can we turn your yard into a garden? And they got friends to say yes. And they started turning these little plots into gardens. And then they went and found the abandoned lots in the community. And they went to the county offices and found out who owned them. And they convinced some of the owners to give them a 5-year lease because the market was low. And they could get a tax write-off by leasing it to this group. They got a 5-year lease. They started growing vegetables in all of these community plots. They then went and bought a refrigerator truck because to own a grocery store is very expensive, but to have a grocery truck that delivers groceries into the neighborhood is much cheaper. They had a spray paint tag artist do the outside of the truck because in a community, it's about how a community responds to something. So this is predominantly African-American and Latin community there. So spray paint art is very popular. So they had a very popular spray paint artist do the outside of the bus, the refrigerator truck, like an ice cream truck that has do-do-do-do-do-do-do. They had music, but it's hip-hop. Boom, 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 pumping out the back of this refrigerator truck. Because part of what you have to think about is young people who've been raised on junk food. That's all they know. Convincing them to eat healthy is a process. So you have to communicate healthy food in a way they can get. So now they've got cool art. They've got hopping hip-hop booming out of the back. And then they started working with young people who were interested in it and training them on how to do peer-to-peer education. They then worked with the government to get the government to allow them to accept food stamps so that they can get people who don't have money have this thing called food stamps where they can buy food. So now they can do the food stamps there. They then started setting up kiosks, little units at all the different schools in West Oakland where the kids can come and get healthy food and snacks on the way in. And on the truck, they also started purchasing bulk food and snacks so that they could bring the price down, but where a kid could get a healthy version of a snack versus a crappy snack out of a vending machine. And now West Oakland is the example, and across the entire country, people from all over the country come to West Oakland to understand how to bring healthy food and communities back into their neighborhoods. And this was started by young people in a community that had 131 liquor stores and one grocery store. If they had allowed that story to rule them, they would have never changed the story. They decided another story was possible, and then they made that story happen. And that's a possibility in overcoming obstacles is all about the stories we tell. So thanks so much for your time. It's been great spending the time with you.